It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get some tips on making soup to warm us up through the rest of winter.
But first, we'll find out the latest on New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's bridge scandal.
The scandal stems from traffic problems back in September when lanes of the George Washington Bridge were closed in an apparent case of political retaliation. Joining us now is Neil King, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Neil, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
Well, briefly, give us, please, the background of the story. What happened?
Well, I mean, going back to early September, all of a sudden, people noticed in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is right on the banks of the Hudson, right at the foot of the George Washington Bridge, that the traffic patterns, basically, there had always been three booths going in to pay your toll. All of a sudden, the three lanes that all the traffic from Fort Lee would use to get onto the George Washington Bridge was reduced down to one toll booth. This caused huge backup all the way into the city, so that it even disrupted life in the town of Fort Lee itself. So questions were asked, why did this suddenly change? What brought this about? And it remained a mystery, with early on some suspicions that some kind of vendetta, some sort of some retribution of some kind was being exacted. But so that kind of rattled around. The election happened. Chris Christie was reelected by wide margins. And then various reporters, including a bunch of us at the Wall Street Journal, started writing, even in the middle of September, looking into this. Why had the Port Authority ordered this, et cetera? So lo and behold, Christie, of course, had denied that there was any involvement by his staff. That was several weeks ago. And then, boom, the morning before last, out come these emails that show that people very senior in his staff, up to his deputy chief of staff, actually had knowledge. When you go sort of thinking of like what kind of smoking gun, if you actually have a smoking gun of an email from a deputy chief of staff of the governor saying, let the traffic problems begin in Fort Lee, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. And so all of a sudden, Governor Christie, you know, presumptive GOP 2016 presidential front runner, among other things, and kind of a darling of the party since he won his big reelection in November, has a big problem on his hands, a big credibility problem, and also a problem where all of a sudden the image that he had built up as gruff, sometimes, you know, in your face, straight talking, but ultimately kind and well-meaning governor was looking very bullish. And that's going to be a problem for him, potentially.
He tackled this head on in a long apology press conference yesterday. He said the buck stops with me, though. He said he didn't know about this. He did not give that order. He was not informed. His staff, he said, lied to him. He apologized to the people of the city affected. What do you think, or what's been the reaction nationally to this apology so far?
Well, I mean, the reaction yesterday after that really pretty extraordinary press conference, which was a great vintage Christie performance, almost 2 hours, took 90 questions. The reaction, particularly among Republicans, and particularly those who support him, which is a large portion of the establishment of the party, was, wow, good job, showed sort of Christie at his best, out there, forthright, taking responsibility. But there's also just a lot of overhang apprehension, because there's a lot of not only unanswered questions, but a lot of stones that still have to be unturned. And he is going to face very large exposure for a long time as a whole bunch of different inquiries now unfold. The entire press corps is looking through all these documents. 1,000 more documents came out today. The Democratic Party of New Jersey and nationally has been totally activated. And because of the blanketness and the emotional, you know, straightforwardness of his denials of any kind of knowledge, if knowledge starts to come out or anything links him to this after all, you know, that could be really damaging. So his exposure is large.
We've got a few, as you mentioned, inquiries, a class action suit from some New Jersey residents. I imagine more may join that suit. Is that something that's going to keep this alive for a while into the future?
That's a good example. I mean, so all of a sudden you have this, what they want to at least have to make into a class action suit of people that were affected by these 4 days of traffic jams. Then you have the state legislature itself having subpoena power and doing its own investigating. And then you have the U.S. Attorney's Office, which yesterday announced that it's going to look at least whether there was potentially some federal crimes possibly involved in, you know, closing off portion of a federal interstate system for political purposes. So that's just some of it. And then the other thing that's really worth noting, I think, I was just looking through my Twitter feed before we came on, and, you know, coverage and sort of the way people look at you, particularly from the reporting side, really matters a lot. And, you know, going into this, Christie was a person who had a certain sort of Teflon coating. Now, all of a sudden, the whole vein of reporting has been opened up. So, you know, one of the stories I saw, 8 videos of Christie yelling, name-calling, and belittling people. Or, you know, it's another story that somebody had dug up. Meet the other mayor that's accusing Chris Christie of retaliation. So you have this whole can of worms that's being opened where it's going to be, you know, full season to look at sort of this other side of Chris Christie that very few people would have paid attention to a month ago. And that's not going to be good.
Looking at Governor Christie's presidential aspirations, let's suppose that the class action suit, the federal, the legislative inquiries are all best case scenarios for him. It turns out it's exactly as he said yesterday. He didn't know anything about this. How much in that case damage do you think it does to his presidential hopes?
Well, I think it's going to take, and it already will have taken some of the gloss off. You know, after, in the last couple of months, when people go out and ask nationally, who do you like for the 2016, he has been the front runner. You know, he gets about 25%, something like that, and then it falls off. But that's normal when you're 2 years out. And the thing about him and what gives him the kind of popularity and what makes him really be seen by a lot of the establishment types is that he has a broad level of support. Women tend to like him a lot more than is normally the case with Republican candidates, Hispanics, et cetera. So we're gonna have to see to what extent there's sort of a damage that's been done because of people looking at him in a different way, maybe even whether he or not he was involved directly with this. It's the idea of like, well, is this sort of the attitude, the kind of culture that he has created or encourages within his office? We'll have to see, and it's going to take a little while before we have any kind of data, but there's I think it's pretty certain that he's going to take some hit in that regard.
There's a wide hypothetical field of GOP presidential hopefuls, including 2 men from Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker, Congressman Paul Ryan. Who, if anyone, would benefit from backsliding in the Chris Christie momentum?
I think both of those two certainly would. I mean, you know, there's a big kind of just to the right of the middle sort of lane that is clearly open that I think may be one of the most promising lanes to be in 2016.
It's not closed.
Exactly. Or are the tolls too high? You know, if he suddenly is crippled, you're going to see Jeb Bush run look all the more promising. Certainly somebody like Scott Walker. I think Paul Ryan would be a decent candidate for that. Or you also start to bring other people in, like Rick Snyder in Michigan, who isn't often talked about, but he would be somebody that would very much fit that bill. And it's also about where does the donor class, the big money type, sort of start to look as an alternative to Chris Christie. Money and organization matter a lot, and if people start to lose confidence in him, the next thing is like, well, who will step up to be the one that sort of, you know, receives the benefits of that, the spillover?
It's January 2014. Is this the kind of thing that we're all buzzing about now, but in a year and a half when people start running their primary campaigns, visiting Iowa, that sort of thing, we'll sort of vaguely remember it as a distant bit of history?
You know, probably and possibly. The thing that's so hard to predict in these things is so that he had his big press conference yesterday. Everybody thought, phew, he escaped a bullet there. But this is just sort of the first phase of one of these things. And for all we know, we'll be looking back and say, wow, we thought he had gotten, you know, everything looked great for him on that Thursday. And now 2 weeks later, can you believe what happened to the guy? Or it could be the other way around and he does sort of come out of this relatively unscathed and we look back and kind of laugh at the conclusions. Because a lot of people, both like Glenn Beck and various of the conservative talk radio people that are no fans of Chris Christie, have already written off his presidential aspirations. And you find a lot of bloggers on the left having done the same. Those all may prove to be premature, that's for sure.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it was a real pleasure.
That's Neil King. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. With the chilly season underway, our buddy Ian Knauer joins us now about how to cook something warm and yummy for winter, soup.
Ian Knauer is a farm-to-table chef and the host of a new PBS series called The Farm. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So until recently, we have been having crazy cold weather here in Wisconsin. Is it kind of similar out in Pennsylvania, or are you enjoying balmy 60-degree weather?
Oh, it's been crazy here as well. 2 days ago, the wind chill was minus 20. Today it's a balmy 34.
So that's decent.
Yeah,
but it's still
cold.
Soup weather, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is the time of year when you want to snuggle up on the bearskin rug in front of the fire and just have a nice big bowl of steamy soup.
So sometimes I get the urge to make soup. I don't have the right ingredients. I don't want to venture out in the cold to get the other stuff. What do I have to have on hand to guarantee I'm going to have enough to make at least a decent basic soup?
Well, I mean, you can. The beauty of soup is that you can really stretch the limits both laterally and longitudinally. If you have a liquid and anything that has flavor, you can stick it in a pot and boil it and add enough salt, and you're going to have something that's going to resemble soup.
I can see Rob thinking of unfortunate things.
Twinkie beer soup.
Actually, that wouldn't be bad at all. In fact, there are lots of beer soups. If you look to like a cheddar soup, a cheddar broccoli soup often has a beer base, and beer is one of those ingredients where you probably have a can of it or a bottle of it in your fridge somewhere, and if you use that instead of water, you're going to add a lot more flavor.
Well, besides the beer, you're also a fan of having celery, carrots, and onion. What's special about that mix?
Well, so this is a classic combination. So whenever you have celery, carrots, and onions, you have what's called in French cuisine a mirepoix, and that is the base of just about everything, from stocks to sauces to soups to braises, because those three flavors work in combination with each other. You have celery, which is a little saline, you have some saltiness to it. You have the onion, which has an earthiness to it, and then you have the carrot, which has a sweetness to it. And when you combine those three things, you get a really balanced flavor.
So how do you go ahead. How do you get started with those?
So these are also things that most people, or at least most people who cook, have on hand. You probably have, you know, half a head of celery and a couple carrots and maybe an onion or two laying around your kitchen at all times. So even if you only have that, you can make a really good soup. In fact, I make one called a mirepoix soup, which is basically a carrot soup that's heavy on celery and onions. Because those flavors are so balanced, you end up with a soup that has a lot of depth to it. So the way to get started on a soup like that, a really simple soup, is to dice up all your veggies, cook your onion in either some olive oil or some butter until it's brown, because by browning it, you get even more flavor. And then add your celery and add your carrots. Maybe go two parts carrots to one part celery, one part onion. And then add whatever liquid you happen to have. It could be white wine. It could be chicken stock. It could even be water if that's what you've got.
Will you get a decent flavor if you're only using water?
You will, actually, because of the combination between the carrot, celery, and onion, they have enough flavor to really bring some substance, bring some foundation to that soup anyway. So you boil it until all the veggies are tender and then blend it up. And if you've got a little cream, throw that in there. Actually, if you have a little some chili flakes or even a little anchovy paste, just a teaspoon or so, put that in there. Your soup's not going to taste like anchovies, but you'll be surprised at how much depth you add just by adding that power ingredient.
So this sounds like a great starter, too, and you can start throwing in other, I'm imagining, veggies or maybe even meats. What kind of things can you add to your, I'll try it, mirepoix to take it in a new direction?
You got it, yeah, good pronunciation. Well, meats would be a really good addition to that because, of course, meat has a lot of flavor. And if you're adding some meat, it could actually be any sort of meat. If you have some beef, you could cut that up into cubes and brown that along with your onions. Even if you have ground beef, you could throw that in there. Of course, veal would be decadent and lovely. Chicken would be great. Even boneless chicken, boneless skinless chicken breast, which, you know, doesn't always have a lot of oomph to it. If you brown it enough, that chicken will actually add to the liquid that you add. So even if you add water to that soup, that chicken will actually make it into a chicken stock. So you'll end up with something that has a lot of flavor there.
Now, a couple of things I like to add. I usually cook vegetarian soups. I will add soy sauce, or sometimes I'll add a veggie Worcestershire sauce. And I feel like those might function the same way as your anchovies do.
Well, they do. In fact, Worcestershire sauce is not vegetarian because it has anchovies in it.
My version
so
is,
be
though.
Be careful there. But soy sauce is a great, great addition there. In fact, anything that's fermented like that will give you a nice, deep flavor. So if you have tamari or if you have miso, would be great in there. That will give you a lot of depth in your soup and still keep it vegetarian.
And we've got a recipe for your carrot soup based on this mirepoix on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR, along with, I think it's, Veronica, it was a black bean soup that Ian sent us?
Right, a vegetarian, I think, black bean soup, but I'm sure you could pop some bacon into it if you wanted to.
Well, that wouldn't hurt. The nice thing about that bean soup is that it actually brings you this sort of satisfying feeling. And it's not necessarily from flavor, although beans have a really nice flavor, but it's from texture. So if you have a soup that really coats your tongue, coats your mouth, you get the sensation of satisfaction. And this soup, you not only blend the beans up, so you blend it in the blender, so it gives it a viscosity, but you also add some coconut milk. And coconut milk is one of those vegetarian substitutes for something like cream. And it really gives you that that satisfying mouthfeel. It's very comforting soup.
What is the flavor like with coconut? Does it end up tasting kind of tropical?
Well, no, not exactly. And that's sort of the interesting thing about it, is that it adds more texture than it does flavor. And the flavor of the beans is quite robust. And I think there's some onion and some garlic in there, too. So mostly it tastes like black bean soup. But the coconut milk does add a little bit of sweetness, which helps balance the savory aspects. But then again, going back to the viscosity point, it's really much more about the texture.
And you did a little cultural detective work to come up with that coconut milk idea, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is based on a soup that I grew up eating as a child. My mother's from Baltimore, Annapolis area. And so we would go down there in the summers and even in the winters and eat at a restaurant called Middleton's, which is in Annapolis, and they would have this famous black bean soup. Now, black bean soup, where does it come from exactly? And so I did some digging, and chances are that this particular black bean soup probably comes from an African-American influence. So there was probably a black cook in the kitchen there who used to throw all the bones that they had in some simmering water and along with the black beans, and then ended up with this really African-influenced soup. That sort of speaks to soup in general. I think some of the best soups that we have worldwide come from cuisines that are not necessarily affluent. So you have poor cuisines like Brazilian, or even if you look to France, you have some country soups that are really satisfying, and they start with basic ingredients like bones and stocks, bay leaves, and you end up with this soup that really, really comforts you.
What do you think about the whole texture of soup question? I know some people who don't like it to be too pureed. They think it's too much like baby food. What do you think about chunky versus pureed?
I think it depends on the soup. There are some pureed soups that really hit home with me, and then there's some chunky soups that are even, border on stews. That I find to be really satisfying as well. So if you have chunks of meat in your soup, you don't necessarily want it pureed. But if you have a really delicate vegetable soup, then that can be really satisfying when you puree it. You get that viscosity, you get that texture when you puree the soup.
We've got your carrot soup. We've got the black bean soup with the coconut milk. Anything you've been kicking around for your next soup experiment as the winter grinds on?
Well, I have to say a tip that I follow and that I think any home cook should sort of invest a little time in, because it doesn't really take much, is some freezer space. So any time that I roast a chicken, for instance, I save the bones, or a turkey, I save the bones and I throw them in a big Ziploc bag and I put them in the freezer. Or any time I want to have shrimp cocktail, I get shrimp with the shells on, and I save the shells in a bag along with, any leftover lobster shells or fish bones, anything that, from the sea. And then when the bag gets full, I throw it in a pot with a mirepoix, so with an onion, some celery, some carrots, maybe some leeks, some bay leaves, whatever I happen to have on hand. And I just simmer that for about an hour, and I end up with a stock. And then that stock goes in containers and goes back in the freezer.
All right. So some good tips there about stocking our freezer. Ian, we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming on and talking soup.
Thanks for having me again, and stay warm.
That was Ian Knauer. He's a farm-to-table chef and host of The Farm.
That's Milwaukee music legend Paul Sebar from his new album, Fine Rude Thing. And he's going to be on What Do You Know this weekend. If you're in the Madison area tomorrow, stop on by and enjoy the fun.
Tickets are available at notmuch.com, or you can get them at the door at the Monona Terrace. Doors open at 9:30 a.m. and the show is at 10. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the founder of the Blue Planet Project about preserving the world's water. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about this year's Consumer Electronics Show, which wrapped up today. We'll take a look at the hottest gadgets and trends from this year's event.
First, it's a resource that a lot of us take for granted, but for hundreds of millions of people across the world, access to clean water is becoming increasingly difficult, and in some cases, there's no access at all.
That has our next guest concerned. She points out that water is a finite resource. She says if we want to live in a water-secure future, we need to start making some changes now.
Joining us is Maud Barlow. She's the head of the Council of Canadians and the founder of the Blue Planet Project. Her new book is called Blue Future. Future, protecting water for people and the planet forever. She's also chair of Food and Water Watch. Maud, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So in 2010, the United Nations General Assembly voted to recognize water as a basic human right. How important would you say that decision was?
Well, it was something I worked on for close to 20 years, so I'm biased. I think it was really important. It didn't mean that the next day that we all woke up in the world and everything was fine, but it did mean that the people of the world, represented by their governments, made a determination that it is not okay for somebody to die or somebody to watch their child die of waterborne disease or lack of access to water in a world where there's so much access, so much money, and really all it comes down to is readjusting, access. So it was a very, very hard fight. Everybody thinks, well, what a motherhood. Of course water is a human right, but you'd be surprised the fight we had. We had a number of countries against it, including my own, Canada, and yours at the time, although the United States has changed its position, is now in favor. But a lot of the big water companies, the World Bank was opposed because it was promoting privatization of water in the global south and so on. So it was quite the battle, and it was a very, very big and important step forward in the fight for water justice.
Well, the politics of water has changed over the years. In fact, just the fact that we have a phrase, politics of water, is something that's new. I think a lot of people take water for granted. Can you talk about why today a declaration like that, declaring water a basic human right, is necessary at all?
Well, you're right. The concept of the politics of water is fairly new because we all grew up believing what we learned in grade six, which is that there's no end to water. It goes around in a hydrologic cycle and it can't go anywhere. Maybe you can pollute it, but certainly it's not going to leave the planet.
Right, the water cycle. I can see the little arrows pointing up into the sky and back down.
We all learned it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's wrong, Veronica. Actually, what we're doing is that we are polluting, displacing, and most importantly, removing water where we can get at it, in groundwater and lakes and rivers and so on. We're damming them to death. We're pumping that groundwater up mercilessly. I mean, the Ogallala Aquifer in your country will be gone, says your Department of Agriculture, in our lifetime. I mean, we are literally taking it from where we can access it to where we can no longer access it, or putting it in the global food trade, huge amount of water and what's called virtual water in commodities and so on. And so where the water is suddenly going is to the places where people have money and power to access it. And the places that people are finding that they don't have water access are the areas of the world that are more poor. Now, we think about it in terms of somewhere like India or, you know, Bolivia, you know, the global south and so on. But it's really important that people get their heads around that as water becomes more scarce and it's becoming more expensive, And there's more of an a political fight about it. There's also this is also happening in the global north. In Detroit, which, as you know, has recently declared bankruptcy, there are close to 90,000 people who've had their water cut off, period. I mean, they may as well be living in a community in the global south. They have to take their buckets and their however they carry their water and go out to public parks or public community centers, fill up the water, and bring it home. They've cut off a lot of people in Europe over the recent austerity measures where they're raising the price of water or privatizing it. So we're on a planet. It's important for people to know, and it's almost impossible if you live near the Great Lakes to really get this because, you know, looking out at those beautiful Great Lakes, you can't imagine they could ever be gone. But we are a planet that is going through our water faster than it can be replenished.
And I want to talk about the privatization of water and also the Great Lakes. But first, you know, you write that the biggest challenge to clean, accessible water is corporate control of water. Can you give us some examples of how that has already been playing out or could be playing out in the years to come?
Well, the big powerful corporations learned before most people did that whoever controls water in the future will be both powerful and wealthy. So you have privatization of municipal water services when municipalities are cash-strapped and need easy money, but then, of course, you're paying for it for generations because it's all based on profit. There's a massive bottled water industry in the world where companies like Nestle and Coca-Cola are taking local water sources, bottling them, shipping them around the world. There's water trading, which is happening in places like Texas and California, where you actually trade the actual water. T. Boone Pickens, your billionaire energy guy, is hoarding and trading Ogallala water. So it happens in a lot of ways that where we transfer water from being kind of a public trust or a public service or this notion that it belongs to all of us, which doesn't mean, by the way, it should be a free-for-all. I'm not saying that. But that notion that we collectively have to take care of it and we all have to have equitable access to moving it to a place where it is for the wealthy. It is a proprietary resource. And more we're finding that the fights are around putting water on sale in the open market like oil and gas. And that's going to be the fight of the future.
You wrote about, I think it was Bolivia, isn't it, where the rights to rainwater were sold at one point.
They not only came in and privatized water. This is at the behest of the World Bank. It was Bechtel. And they tripled the price of water, but they said to the people, we own the water coming out of the sky, and any water you capture in buckets or cisterns or whatever, which is traditional in most countries, we own, you have to pay for it. They had inspectors going around saying you have to pay for it. You can imagine there was a revolution, literally an armed revolution, and the company was forced to leave. But I mean, and now that's an extreme, but I think in a world where the demand is going straight up and the supply is going straight down, you're going to see more of that kind of struggle in the future than less.
Well, so in the book, you lay out four principles for a water-secure future. I want to start with the first one, water as a human right. And we talked about how that had just been declared recently by the United Nations General Assembly. But how does that play out on the ground? How do we assure that water is a human right for people?
Well, in some countries, it's quite obvious where you have, the majority of the population not having access to sanitation or clean water. Then you have to really retool the way you spend money, and the money coming from groups like the World Bank has to go to providing accessible public health care or water care rather than allowing it to go to the private companies. In a country like Canada or the United States, where most people have access to clean water, it's more two issues. One is American Native or Canadian First Nations communities, we find there's a high incidence of lack of clean water, access to clean water. But we're finding more and more that it's when the water gets destroyed by a practice. Maybe it's fracking the local energy supply, or maybe it's a coal top mountain coal mining, or other areas that or other ways that we abuse water, and then the local people have no right or access to clean water. It might be in California, where the best water goes by in canals to the wealthy farmers of Southern California, and the local people have to bring in bottled water because they can't afford the clean water that's going by them. So it's going to take different forms in different parts of the world, but it all has the same principle that we should not allow water to go to be taken by those with money while those without have to go without water.
Now, you mentioned water used in fracking. That's something we in Wisconsin are interested in. We have a big frack sand mining operation, or at least interest here in Wisconsin. Tell us about how water is used in fracking.
Well, interesting. I'm just writing a new report on the Great Lakes and the threat of extreme energy, including fracking and this tar sands energy coming from Canada, which was involved in this recent decision around Wisconsin and Superior, Wisconsin. Fracking is exploding in the United States, as you know. Fracking has meant that the United States has gone from seeing itself as, you know, having to continue to be an importer of energy to eventually becoming an exporter. The United States has recently become the major gas producer in the world, and that's because of fracking. But what it does, fracking uses an enormous amount of water. It destroys an enormous amount of water through the chemical compound that allows the process to happen. And generally, they leave the water in the ground, in underground storage, which then, of course, leaks into the local groundwater. Recently, this is very distressing to know, the Coast Guard in the United States has said that it's going to permit fracked wastewater to be transported on large barges on America's rivers and lakes, which is an accident waiting to happen because the chemicals that used in the fracking process are volatile. That whenever you hear about these train wrecks involving fracked oil from the back in fields in North Dakota, it's because of the xylene and toluene and these kinds of compounds that explode on impact that we're hearing about these terrible disasters. So it's something we need to really talk about, and those of us who live near or on the Great Lakes really need to say no to more fracking around the Great Lakes, because I think it's going to put our lakes in great danger.
We're talking with Maude Barlow right now about the future of Earth's water, and we want to hear from you. What do you think should be done to protect the world's water and to make it accessible? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. Right now, here's a look at headlines with Noah Ovshinsky. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Maude Barlow about the future of the world's water. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Maude, you may have heard it there on our newscast. There's a story in the news today that I wanted to get your take on. In West Virginia, we heard about a chemical leak that has contaminated the water supply for about 100,000 residents. Wondering what your reaction is to that and what should be the takeaway.
Yes, that's had international news, as a matter of fact. Well, what I call for in the book is that we need a new water ethic, and we need to place the protection of water at the center of everything we do. We cannot be having these kind of accidents and then saying, well, then let's go back to the company and tell them not to let it happen again. We have to have laws that protect water and watersheds. We only have a tiny, tiny, small amount of fresh, finite, clean water on our planet. And if you see a photograph of the Earth to size with all the water gone, this is a great big brown ball, and then beside it's a little blue ball, but that includes all the ocean and soil water. Beside it is a tiny little pinprick of blue. That's all the fresh water that we have on Earth. And if we had a different mindset and didn't see water as a resource to make our lives more convenient, you know, for profit, to move it around, dump whatever we want in it, think about it after the fact. If we had a different mindset that said, no, everything we do, from our agricultural policy to our energy policy to our environmental regulations, have to say, protect that water, protect those watersheds. There isn't another set of these watersheds around the world. I mean, we have to protect what we have. And I hope that this will act as a wake-up call for the people, because it's horrible when this happens and you try to fix it up after the fact. And by the way, if you think it's going to cost money to protect it before these accidents happen, think about the money it costs after these accidents happen.
I want to ask you one more question, and then I want to go to our phone lines because we have a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. Earlier, you talked about the dangers of corporate control of water and how it needs to be accessible to everyone. And for a long time, people have been predicting water wars. That's not necessarily something that's new. We've been hearing that in the past decade. Is there a case to be made that if there is privatization of water, that at least there is an organized institution that is, you know, an entity that can be dealt with at a governmental level, an institutional level, rather than sort of just a free-for-all over water?
No, the greater danger is that privatization leads to that confrontation because it really then becomes the profit motive versus the public good. If you have proper public trust law, which is what we need, I mean, you have it better entrenched in your country than many, and certainly around the Great Lakes, there's public trust law, but it isn't understood and it isn't enforced properly. If you have public trust law, you're basically saying, look, this water, the water of the Great Lakes, for instance, belongs to the people who live on and depend on the Great Lakes. It belongs to all of us collectively. And nobody has the right to come along and destroy it or take it for private profit. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a place for water in private industry. Of course there is, but those industries would have to convince the owners of the water, that is the public trust, that they're going to take care of it and that they're not going to overuse it or abuse it, and they're going to put it back as clean as is humanly possible, you know, if they've been using it and returning it. And then that becomes their responsibility to convince us, the public, that they're going to take care of it. That's a very different concept than allowing the market to take it and then having a deregulated environment, which is, of course, what the private sector always goes for, so that then they can do what they want with that water or with the water that they've bought. So I think, you know, I'm not against the private sector. We need private sector in the world. That's not my point. But there are certain things that should be outside the marketplace. And when you have a declining water source in the world and a growing demand, you have to have very specific rules to make sure that it's protected as a public trust, as a public service, and as mm-hmm. a human right. And by the way, when I say human right, I don't mean you have the right to use whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. There's no human right to water for golf courses or swimming pools. We're not talking about that kind of free-for-all.
Let's go to our phones now. We have Andrew with us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Doing okay. What do you think about water?
What do I think about water? So my comment, in some ways, it's sort of been addressed in the ensuing, you know, conversation or dialogue here, but in terms of private property rights versus more of a public doctrine approach. But I guess my overall comment was just kind of exploring that theme a little bit more. You know, if I'm certainly sympathetic to the notion that water's, should be ought to be a basic human right, just like I feel that way about housing. It's kind of a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, grew up in Madison. At the same time, I've, you know, been around long enough to see plenty of situations where, you know, not just here in this country, but around the world, where you don't put a value on something like water, that the resource can be abused and, you know, poorly allocated, just like it can be when it's under total, you know, corporate private control. So what are some other ways, you know, we can approach pricing and allocation of water that would be more equitable in your opinion? And you know, and ultimately, if we do decide it's, you know, to treat it like we would, you know, recreational access to recreational fishing waters in Wisconsin or something, how do we ultimately decide, you know, who actually decides, you know, whether that drop goes to a farmer or an endangered, you know, toad or such and such community down the, right, you know, in the area.
All right, good questions. Thank you, Andrew.
Well, Andrew, those are fabulous questions, and I don't for a minute say that because water should not be privately controlled that there should be no rules. I'm not saying that at all. When we talk about a public trust here, I'm talking about a fiercely managed public trust, and we need strong rules, and we're calling for the Great Lakes to be considered a public trust, and we need common laws, and I think we should be saying things like no, you know, tar sands oil or no fracked oil being transported, crack down on those big barges coming in and dumping their ballast where the invasive species are coming in. And so, I mean, believe me, I would have a lot of regulations to protect the Great Lakes if I were the queen of the Great Lakes. So it's not that. When we talk about pricing, we tend to think about it as individual families or small businesses paying. But in fact, the great use of water is raw water. It's only about 9% of all water that's used in residential and small businesses. The big water is agribusiness, it's hydroelectric, it's the mining companies and so on. So my argument is that why are we giving away or subsidizing this raw water for profit-making companies that then turn around and sell it back to us or sell the product that they got out of that water back to us? I think it's time we had a discussion about it's kind of like charging royalties, you know, a royalty for this water if you're a private company making money from it. We would make a lot more money that way than we're going to ever make from private families to put back into protection of water source and to ensure the fair distribution of water. But I'm not at all talking about a free-for-all. I really want to ensure your listeners that.
Andrew, thank you for that call. And let's go next to Penelope in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Penelope.
Hi. I was hoping that you could speak to virtual water, the water used in the manufacturing process of our disposable goods and our disposable culture and how we waste water just in as consumers.
Thank you so much, Penelope. I write about this a lot in the book. Most people don't know what it is. In fact, what the United Nations has been using a statistic about how much water we all use on average every year, but the recent studies tell us that if you include what virtual water we use, that's all the water in the food that you eat, the electronics that you use, the clothing that you wear, all the stuff that needed water to create or to produce, then it's about 10 times what we thought the average water footprint was. And we tend to look, if we think, well, I'm going to save water, I'm going to get those low-flow shower heads and, you know, the appliances that are better and so on, and I'll turn the water off when I brush my teeth, and that all that's good. But that doesn't really touch the massive amount of water that we use, and that's the water mostly, actually, in our global food trade. So one of the answers to the water crisis is more local, sustainable food production, that if something can be grown closer to home, that's the food product that you should be importing. That we in Canada should not be eating those great big steroid fat strawberries in January, you know, and that we think more carefully about what products and what commodities use water and how we can promote better use and protection of water by moving to more local sustainable production.
All right, Penelope, thank you for that. And Maude, in our last 35 seconds or so here, you've written about water and a pretty bleak future if nothing changes with our current water practices. What is the most important thing that we need to do and advocate for if we want to avoid the future you describe?
Well, I want people to have hope. The book is actually called, you know, as you know, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. I believe that if we could see water as a public trust, as a common heritage, that we could see that water itself has rights and that we could move towards water being nature's gift to teach us how to trust one another and treat one another better, that we could actually use water as a vehicle for peace and not war. So I actually come out with a hopeful message, but I think you have to start with the truth, and the truth is we've taken it for granted and we need to stop doing that.
Maude, thank you so much for being with us today.
My entire pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Maude Barlow, head of the Council of Canadians and founder of the Blue Planet Project. Her new book is called Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. She's also chair of Food and Water Watch.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at some of the cool stuff to come out of this year's Consumer Electronics Show, which just wrapped up today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.